the little house. He might be bound, but that was no reason to turn her back. He complied, instinctively searching for the light panel as soon as he entered. Blue-white light dusted the room, not enough to eradicate the darkness, but enough to lift the heaviest shadows. The space was divided into two rooms, one large and open with a chest in one corner and rows of hooks along the ceiling, the other containing something like a bathroom. They found hammocks in the chest, and together hung two from the ceiling hooks. The windows were open and lined with curtains of a finely woven netting to keep out the bugs. But even so, the corners were littered with insect carcasses and clumpy spiderwebs. It was warm. The air clung to her skin, and seemed to intrude on the fabric of Caledonia's clothing, making it feel dense and damp. It was going to be an uncomfortable night in a strange place. And she was tethered to a boy she'd tried to kill twice. Perhaps she'd make it three. For a brief second, she entertained the thought of finally putting him over the rail and letting him drown. Without his hands to tread water, he might survive for a little while. But eventually, his legs would give out, and he'd slip beneath the surface. The thought didn't give Caledonia as much pleasure as she'd expected. It left an uncomfortable crook in its wake. A sea snake disturbing the flow of water. Sipo was right to call him poison. There was something truly insidious about him. So insidious, Caledonia had stopped wishing for his immediate demise. Orin stood 4 feet away, just far enough that the tether drooped between them. No matter how they arranged themselves, it would pull taut between the hammocks, and there was the possibility that Orin would wait until Caledonia fell asleep and strangle her with the slack. She would have to undo the tether and bind him to the hammock. She had no weapons to consider. She'd given her blades to Pisces for safekeeping, and Sipa hadn't offered to return any of their guns. Though it left Caledonia feeling unbalanced, she could admit it was the better move. Both for the slaggers, who in spite of Hime had very little reason to trust the girls, and for her current situation. If she were armed right now, she'd be removing bullets and securing knives in case Orin got creative. There could be nothing worse than being stabbed with your own blade. That was a fate she saved for Lear. She gestured to one of the two hammocks hanging in the middle of the room and, when Orin was settled, lifted his hands above his head and secured them to the chain of the hammock. The skin around his bindings was red and raw in places, painfully so. Caledonia tied her knots with a careful hand, jostling the wounds only a little in the process. Orin watched her work, dark eyes strangely unyielding, supine body relaxed despite her ministrations. She waited for him to beg for her to loosen his bonds, or to promise he meant her no harm. But he didn't speak. He simply watched her. When the knots were set, she settled into her hammock, and an awkward silence. Now that she no longer had to acknowledge him, Caledonia leaned into the scoop of fabric and closed her eyes. There was no better way to demonstrate she didn't consider him a threat than to pretend she barely knew he was there. But she couldn't have been more aware of him. Every little creak of his hammock reminded her that he swayed a few short feet to her left. She could hear his breath well enough to know he inhaled through his nose and exhaled softly through his mouth. She thought she could even smell his sweat, though if she was being very honest with herself, there was a good chance it was her own. At least her crew was somewhere comfortable and safe. At least her ship wasn't being torn apart. At least they still had time to get to the North Water and save their brothers. "Thank you." Her eyes snapped open. She turned to find Orin still watching her. Had he been watching her this whole time? She scowled. for saving my life today. I know you didn't have to, and I'm grateful. I'm not concerned with your thanks or your gratitude. She thought she detected the hint of a smile on his mouth, and she wanted to hit it hard. You don't have to be, he shifted, finally turning his eyes away from her. But you have it regardless. It's worthless, she snapped. The gratitude of a bullet. I didn't save you from the slaggers because you deserved it. I saved you because you have intel I need. As soon as this is done, I'll turn you over to the first person who asks nicely. His hammock creaked, but he said no more. A small but welcome breeze slithered through the windows, whispering against the netting and sipping at the stifling humidity. Outside, the nightbirds were beginning to sing in long, looping voices. Bugs clacked and chittered. And every so often, there was the very distant sound of laughter or a door slamming. Missing from it all was the sound of water. It was an odd sensation to know that she was on the water and yet so removed from the rocking of its arms. Something bumped beneath them and Caledonia shot to her feet. Food, Oren said calmly. Sipa said someone would come to deliver some food. He was right, of course, but the fact irritated Caledonia as she hurried out to the deck and opened the hatch in time for a silver-haired woman to deftly swing her bundle onto the floor. She stayed on the ladder, showing no signs of wanting to come all the way up. With some surprise, Caledonia realized it was the grandmother from the court, Jules, who'd argued in their favor. The woman shook her head slowly, small silver trinkets clinking in her hair. So young. Up close, you're even younger than I realized. In her head, Caledonia heard Amina's response to Clag and Cloudbreak. Only in years. It had only been a matter of days since that moment. But she felt every one as if they stacked up on her shoulders. Nothing had gone well since that strange man directed them to Doc Tricius. Maybe too young, Caledonia surprised herself with her honesty. But it felt good to show this small corner of her worries to someone she wasn't responsible for. Maybe it was seeing Hime reunited with her mother. Maybe it was all the ways the queen made her think of her own mother. Whatever it was, suddenly Caledonia didn't want this grandmother to leave. Young, but not a child. With one hand, Jules reached out to caress Caledonia's cheek. Her calloused fingers were rough and gentle at the same time, hardened by work and softened by age. There are no children anymore, just babes and the rest of us. Remember, when they call you girl, they're trying to tell you something. They're trying to tell you that they're more than you, that the body you're in makes you less. But you know, and I know, that you're exactly what you need to be. Caledonia put her hand on the paper-soft skin of the woman's arm. Thank you. There's enough for the boy, Jules said with a grim smile. But make sure you take the whale's share, love. And then she was gone, leaving words that resounded like bells in Caledonia's mind. She sat there on the floor of the deck for a long moment after Jules left, letting those words burrow into her mind and take root. Whatever Jules had left for them smelled divine. Caledonia's stomach roared, reminding her just how long it had been since she'd eaten. She scooped up the basket and took it inside, unpacking it on the floor some distance from Oren. There were several wooden boxes, each containing a steaming delight, a dark meat in thick gravy, white turnips on a bed of leafy vegetables so dark they looked black under these lights. And in the last, a small loaf of fresh, buttery bread. Two bottles contained clear, drinkable water, and in a very small tin, she found coarse salt. Oren didn't even try to hide his hunger. He sat up at the only awkward angle his bindings allowed, braced his legs on the floor, and watched as Caledonia revealed each dish, his mouth slightly agape. Her first thought was to deny him, make him watch as she took her fill and his portion grew steadily smaller. But there was something about hunger, something about the hopeful way his eyes studied the steam. As empty as her belly was, his was surely worse. With an internal groan, Caledonia got to her feet and untied the rope tethering him to the hammock. "Come on," she muttered. "You can't help me if you starve to death." They sat with legs crossed around the arrangement of dishes. There were no utensils, so they ate with their hands, using the bread to scoop up every bit of the gravy. It was good. There was no question about that. But they ate too quickly to know if the turnips were more tender than the meat or if the greens were bitter. Oren waited for Caledonia to take her fill of each dish before diving in. The bindings on his wrists did little to slow him down. He lifted the gravy dish to his face, licking the corners clean and acquiring a dab of gravy on the tip of his nose. Caledonia almost laughed as he hurried to wipe it away, embarrassed by the mess on his face. But somehow, not the method of making that mess. "I think the only thing I'll miss about the bullet fleet is the food," Oren said, licking the last of the gravy from his fingers. "Eric is a demon and a bastard, but he knew what he was doing when he built his agri-fleet." The bale barges were only one slice of that fleet. The rest supported a wide range of fruits and vegetables, ensuring that bullets were healthy and strong, even while their minds dulled under the constant pressure of that drug. "What about Silt? It's only been a few days, but they say the first days are their worst. Don't you want it again?" Oren's expression darkened. "I will not miss the Silt," he said, as though convincing himself. "You sure?" she asked. "I've never seen anyone break the habit as cleanly as you." His body tensed. "This isn't my first time." "What does that mean?" she asked. Oren stood and moved to the window. He took a long draught of his water before answering. "Sometimes Silt is withheld. For a day, maybe two. It's a punishment."
"Seems counterproductive." Caledonia climbed to her feet, studying the bullet from behind. "Why weaken your fleet like that?"
"Because it reminds them how much they need it and him," Oren answered quickly.
Caledonia shivered. "But a day or two isn't enough to break the habit," she pressed.
He nodded, keeping his face turned away. "Sometimes the punishment is worse."
She wanted to know more. She wanted to know why he'd been punished, and whether or not Donnelly had suffered in the same way. And without thinking, she leaned close to skim one of the three bands on his bicep with her fingertips. He spun, snatching her wrist in his hand as though the touch had burned. His breath was hot on her mouth, their bodies inches apart. He looked boldly into her eyes. Angry, and somehow also afraid. For just a second, it undid her. Then, just as quickly, he dropped her hand again and leaned away. Caledonia's heart pounded. The place where he'd gripped her was hot, but he hadn't hurt her. He'd stopped himself on the precarious edge of violence. She didn't speak, and neither did he. They cleaned up, setting the empty tins outside on the deck. Oren offered his hands to be rebound to the chain, and Caledonia sank into her hammock, feeling unsettled. For a moment, the only sounds were of the night bugs and the breeze through the window. Then, Oren's voice rumbled.
I'm sorry, Caledonia.
Caledonia turned her back to him and shut her eyes. Chapter 27. When Caledonia next saw the Mors Navis, it was moving past her window at daybreak. She was up in an instant, peeling back the window netting to see her ship propped in a floating dry dock and moving more deeply into the drowning lands. She took note of every gash and seam. They couldn't always make solid repairs at sea, but they'd done their best. The Mors Navis was a tough ship, and Caledonia was relieved to see her all in one piece. The repair shouldn't take too long. Orin was still asleep in his hammock, arms bound firmly above his head. In the gray light of dawn, he was drawn in softer strokes. Though the air had cooled to a pleasant temperature overnight, his forehead was covered in a thin layer of sweat, and his brows were delicately furrowed. He looked almost gentle, vulnerable to whatever gnarled demons Eric had left inside him. Caledonia rubbed her wrist, reminding herself what happened when she forgot how vicious those demons were. "Get up!" Caledonia made her voice loud and hard, chasing away his sleep and her flash of sympathy in the same breath. "It's time to go." To his credit, Orin didn't ask a single question. He was up as soon as his hands were free and was ready to go only minutes later. They nearly tripped over breakfast on their way. Someone had cleared their empty dinner dishes and replaced them with a bundle containing rolls, soft cheese, and fresh berries. They paused long enough to cram cheese-stuffed rolls into their mouths, but took the berries and bottles of water with them. She briefly considered positioning Orin in the front of the boat where she could keep him in her sights. It would remove opportunities for him to surprise her, but she didn't want to spend more time than necessary staring at his head. And putting him at her back was a stronger message. It said, "I'm not afraid of you. You are no threat to me." Early daylight filtered through the scatter of trees in rays of warm orange and cool yellow. Bugs stitched the surface of the water together with little nips and tucks, and beneath darted minnows and fish. Canoes slid between the trees and stilts, ruffling the water as people went about their morning tasks. The drowning lands were awake, above and below. Bound as he was, Orin added his strong strokes to hers, and they soon found their rhythm in the unfamiliar boat. At first, Caledonia offered directions, but after a short time, Orin responded to the subtle shifts in her oar, adjusting his own before she could give a command. There was something very calming about the work, the slow, steady rhythm of the oars, the music of water dripping from them. The air was fresh and cool, and though they were surrounded by the waking sounds of the village, it felt serene. They arrived at the crew's cluster of stilted houses to find Sipa and Pisces seated at an outdoor table chatting over steaming cups. "Tea, Captain," Sipa offered as Caledonia drew near. "I have none for the bullet." Pisces didn't bother hiding her disapproval at the snub. "Thank you," Caledonia accepted a mug of the fragrant drink, taking a seat near Sipa. Orin stood as far from the table as the tether allowed, but it was more awkward knowing he lurked than having him close. Caledonia gestured to the seat next to her, and Orin took it. "We've had a chance to assess the damage to your ship," Sipa said. She was already dressed in plates of gray armor. Caledonia had the impression the woman was never without it. "She's taken quite a beating. Needs work." 4 encounters in the past 10 days. But that ship had taken more than the sum of these skirmishes combined. "I don't need her perfect. I need her capable." Caledonia didn't like the casual tone in Sipa's voice. "How long will it take?" "With your crew assisting? 9 days, Sipa stated. "Maybe 10. 10 days! Caledonia was on her feet. We don't have that kind of time.
If Orin's timeline was accurate, they had 14 days to reach the North Water ahead of the Electra. It would take 4 days under ideal conditions to sail from the Drowning Lands to the North Water. More if they encountered trouble. 10 days for repairs would leave them scrambling. Their brothers might be gone before they reached the North Water at all.
She was sailing just fine when we left her, Pisces said smoothly, her gaze urging Caledonia to stay calm.
Propulsion was gummed up, but we could have had it cleared in a day.
What did you do to her?
Sipa merely shrugged, rising from her seat.
Taking ships apart is what we do, friends, and we do it fast. Putting them back together takes us a bit longer.
The crew was beginning to awaken, emerging from houses on all sides of the deck in search of breakfast. Caledonia bit down on her irritation. In the distance, her crew grew louder, seeming to echo the rumble in her own chest.
No one knows the Mors Navis like my crew. We'll cut that time down. A week is all we have to spare.
Orin cleared his throat.
Our timeline's actually a little shorter than you think. Electra will start her run with the waxing crescent moon. That's our timeline.
What?
A familiar anger tinged Caledonia's response. Why?
We do everything in alignment with the moon. The waxing crescent is a time of growth and potential, perfect for gathering recruits.
She'd heard it before. Bullets were deeply superstitious and looked to the moon for signs and portents of things to come. But this was the first time she'd heard it in such detail.
The waxing crescent is in 12 days, Pisces said with renewed alarm.
12 days? Not 14, 12. They had to get out of here.
Before she could say another word, the noise from the crew spiked. The rumbling rose in a sharp crescendo, and the girls danced into an excited circle across the deck. That's when the cheers began. It was a sign of one thing only. Fight. While she was usually in favor of the girls blowing off steam, this was not the time or place for it. Orin followed as Caledonia strode across the deck and released a piercing whistle.
Heads high, girls!
Immediately her girls quieted, raising their heads and releasing the circle. In the center stood two figures. Red Tooth, which didn't surprise Caledonia at all, and Amina, which couldn't have surprised her more. Red Tooth would fight with anyone, but Amina? Amina wasn't the brawling sort. The two girls stepped apart, Amina with her hands braced against her hips, eyes hard and pinned to the captain. Red Tooth with blood tracking down her chin and a pained look for Amina.
Whatever it was, is it settled? Caledonia asked. Or do you need me to settle it for you?
Amina's eyes cut away. Red Tooth grumbled under her breath.
Louder, Red, Caledonia ordered.
I only said.
She paused to put another foot of distance between herself and Amina.
I thought lovely Hime was going to stay with her mom.
Understanding washed over Caledonia, taking her anger with it. In its place was a quiet and sudden squeeze of apprehension. It had been an unspoken possibility since they landed here. Everyone knew they might be losing Hime, and in this moment, Caledonia feared there was no other possible outcome. She saw that same fear humming through the girls still standing near, a chord in search of a song. These girls were so accustomed to the fight that if they went too long without, they'd find one. Being still for too long was no good for girls with the current in their blood.
Sipa, she called to the woman leaning against a doorframe with a full view of the show. My crew's ready to get to work.
Chapter 28. It took 21 canoes to transport the crew to the Mors Navis.
By the time they had everyone there, the sun was high overhead, the air thickening with humidity. At first glance, the ship looked much as it had when they left it. But closer inspection revealed significant damage to the forward hull. Sipa had not exaggerated her people's destructive expertise. While the crew boarded, Caledonia and Pisces surveyed the exterior of the ship. The dry dock was a marvel all on its own. Two walls and a floor of rusted metal capable of lifting a ship completely out of the water and moving it long distances. The girls were able to walk right up to the lowest point of the Mors Navis hull and run their hands over the distressed seams. Orin followed along behind, careful to never let the tether pull tight between them. Every time he moved, Caledonia was reminded of how aware of her he was. No matter what she did, he was prepared to move in some corresponding fashion. It wasn't obedience, she realized. It was perception. She must always be in the corner of his eye and the front of his mind. I think we can do it in 6 days, Pisces said, breaking into her thoughts. We know these tools. If we work through the nights, our girls can get it done. Good, Caledonia swept her mind clear of Orin. Get Lace to drop the work teams. If the cabins aren't damaged, we can have rotations here and in the cabins in town.
Tin, Pisces corrected her in a soft voice. You mean tin.
Caledonia's stomach pitched, and for just a second, it was like losing Lace all over again. If Lace were here, she'd have run this operation without a hitch. But Lace wasn't here. They'd lost her. She'd lost her. And her crew still hadn't found its footing again. Or maybe it was just that she hadn't. Of course, Tin, she said, nodding too quickly and forcing her mind to hurry past its grief. We'll get Tin on the duty roster. I want one of our crew here at all times. The Queen may have ordered her people to help, but there are at least some who don't agree with her. I don't want to give them any opportunity to take what's ours.
Done, Pisces confirmed, eyes casting back toward the village.
Any sign of Hime? Caledonia asked. Perhaps it was the fight between Amina and Redtooth that made her think of it. Or perhaps it was the nagging fear that she was about to lose a second crew member.
She was here last night, briefly. But she left with her mother.
Pisces paused, glancing up toward the deck at the sounds of their crew settling into their work. The ship began to rumble gently as some of its systems were tested.
It goes without saying, but Amina's not taking it very well.
You think she'll stay? Caledonia asked, though she felt like she already knew the answer. All she could remember were the moments Hime had expressed frustration with Caledonia, with her own role on the ship. At every turn, they'd held Hime back, kept her from the fight she so desperately wanted to join. Why would she stay with them when all Caledonia had done was tell her no?
Pisces looked pained for a moment, as if she were pondering the same thing.
I don't know, she said softly.
I think she'll stay with you.
Orin's voice surprised them both. They turned to find him leaning against the weathered hull, brown eyes flashing in the sun.
Why?
Pisces asked, voice gentle.
She was a scythe, he said, simply, apologetically. The fight is part of her now.
What does that mean? Caledonia asked. Orin's mouth dipped into a brief frown.
Kids who end up in the family of the father go one of two ways. They either fight or they don't. If she wasn't a fighter, she'd have left you long ago, one way or another. But she's with you. She needs to fight almost as much as she needs anything else.
He gestured to the long clutch of silvery trees, the still-surfaced water surrounding the dry dock.
She won't get that here.
Caledonia understood that he knew this because he was talking about himself as much as Hime. She didn't know if the sensation in her chest was a resigned kind of sadness or an unsettling sense of comfort. She met his eyes and was surprised when her first thought was that they looked honest.
"Captain!" Red Tooth appeared, standing in the gash at the front of the hull. She leapt to the ground with a firm smack of her boots. A long bruise was darkening along her pale jaw. Amina had not pulled her punches. "The hold's in good shape. You can dump that bullet while we're here, so you don't have to cart him around with you."
"Or I can help." Oren stepped closer to the small group.
"My hands work, and I'm pretty good with ships. A ship tech, actually."
Red Tooth pushed a finger into his face.
"Damn dirty bullets don't touch my ship. Try it, and I'll put you down."
Then, as an afterthought, she added,
"Unless the captain says otherwise."
"Believe me," Oren said with a grim smile for Red Tooth.
"I've felt the hammer of your fist. I'm not touching anything until you tell me to."
"We should let him help," Pisces said. "There's a lot of work to get done, and he's capable. I'll watch him."
"No," Caledonia's voice was decisive. "The Queen's orders are clear. He's to stay tethered to me at all times. I'm not going to give them any excuse to think I've disobeyed, so he'll stay with me. Basic tasks only."
Pisces wasn't fast enough to hide her frown, but Red Tooth gave the boy a satisfied glare. He smiled in return, saying,
"I might not be quite the hammer Red Tooth is, but I'll do my best."
Red Tooth leaned in to answer.
"Don't feel too bad about it. The way you take a beating, you make one hell of a nail."
Chapter 29. The next days vanished between long hours of work and short hours of sleep. Tin put the crew through its paces, implementing a punishing duty rotation. Caledonia and Pisces took turns, ensuring one of them was always present on the ship, and Nettle was given the task of sounding alarms when it was time for the next shift to wake and return to work. By the end of the sixth day, the Mors Navis was in better shape than she'd been in years. They would be ready to leave in the morning. Caledonia's cabin was a lot smaller with her command crew crammed inside, but they made do, taking down the hammocks to make more space. Oren sat in one corner of the room beneath the shadow of Red Tooth, who loomed over him like a mast pole. Caledonia had released the tether again, more for her comfort than his. After days of working side by side, they'd found a strange sort of harmony that consisted mostly of Oren anticipating Caledonia's movements. They'd taken Lace's map of the bullet seas from the Mors Navis and spread it out between them. A small chunk of metal representing the Mors Navis was mired in the drowning lands. "Starting tomorrow, we have 6 days, Caledonia said. "And from here, we're headed straight up through the perpetual storm." She tried to sound confident, but none of them knew what to expect in those waters. "Oren, show us the best point of interception once we reach the North Water." Oren was on his feet before she finished speaking. Taking a gnarled pencil from Amina's hand, he lightly laid out the North Water conscription routes. They were as expected. The only difference was that Oren worked with a confident hand, marking each specific stop along the northern colonies with precision. "Here," he said, marking the westernmost edge of the routes. "If we get there early enough, we'll have time to hide in one of these coves and catch them off guard."
"And what about the Electra herself?"
Oren flipped to the schematic he'd been drafting every evening after returning from the Mors Navis. He'd located the coils that generated the electric field around the exterior of the ship and indicated the most strategic point of impact that would compromise the ship without tipping it over.
"I can't guarantee it, but your brother used to be assigned to the engines, here," he said to Pisces. "And yours is more likely to be in the command tower somewhere," he said without raising his eyes to Caledonia.
They studied the schematic in silence. Placing Amina's electromag was easy in theory. As long as they got close enough, they'd disabled the hull before the Electra knew they were under attack. It was the second part of this plan that was challenging. How to storm the ship without accidentally killing the brothers. Every single plan the crew had ever executed was designed without a care for the lives of their enemies. Saving bullet lives ran against every natural instinct they possessed.
"Never thought I'd be trying to figure out how not to kill bullets," Red Tooth grumbled.
"There has to be a way." Pisces studied the schematic feverishly, as if in looking away she would miss the moment it revealed the answer.
"There is."
Every head snapped up at the sound of Orin's voice.
"Send me in. I can get aboard without much trouble. Once I'm there, I can find your brothers and get them off ship."
No one spoke, and Orin continued.
"There's a good chance they won't have heard that I turned traitor, so they'll have no reason to suspect me."
"Bullets have radios," Amina said.
"Yes, but short range only, and Electra's hull makes even that a challenge. Her own electrical field gets in the way of communication."
"That's true," Amina confirmed.
"And their radios are shorter in range in the north because there are fewer towers. The colonists destroy them whenever they find them."
Amina spoke with the confidence of someone from the region. Eric had tried to subdue the hands of the river in the same way he had the northern colonies, but the braids were too winding and expansive to control.
"Send me in," Orin spoke again. "It's a low-risk plan."
He was right. They could send him in, let him bear all the heavy lifting. If he was discovered, they'd have lost nothing. Unless this had been his plan all along, gain their trust, learn their ship, and lure them into an elaborate trap.
"Drug rot," Red Tooth said, getting close to peer into Orin's eyes. "Got his brain."
"Seems like a good idea to me." Amina turned back to her own plans, unconcerned with whatever fate awaited Orin.
"It's no loss to us if they catch him."
"No loss to us. It's a suicide mission," Pisces rounded on Caledonia.
"Kala, you can't consider this. You know what they'll do to him."
"I'm considering everything." Caledonia took Pisces' hand in hers, naturally weaving their fingers together, trying to ignore the twinge of concern she felt whenever Pisces leapt to the defense of this boy. Turning to Orin, she asked,
"Why would you do something so risky?"
Here, Orin stumbled, but he covered it quickly with a wry smile.
"You're going to hand me over eventually anyway, right? Might as well put the time I have to good use."
Pisces' fingers curled around Caledonia's. They all knew what would happen to a disloyal son of Eric's, and it was no easy death. That didn't bother her, or it shouldn't. What bothered her was the thought of sending a bullet to do their work. What bothered her was the thought of trusting a bullet to do their work. Making him the linchpin of their plan put everything and everyone at risk.
"No," Caledonia said decisively. "We'll find another way."
In the end, the only plan that seemed to have any chance whatsoever was the first. Disable the electrical field, ram the ship, and board with a low kill order. It wasn't perfect, but it was what they had. If they didn't take this chance, it would be another 10 months before the Electra traveled the Northwater routes again. And by then, Orin's information would be old enough to be all but useless. The command crew departed as Jules arrived with another stack of boxes containing dinner for Caledonia and Orin. This time, there was a young girl who scampered up the ladder ahead of her. On her back was a small satchel, which she offered to Caledonia with a soft smile.
"Blankets," she said. "We could have a chill tonight. There's even one for him."
She was easily as old as Nettle, yet somehow younger. Her long brown hair was thin like Jules, and wrapped in a bun on the top of her head to match.
"Thank you, Tilly," Jules called. That'll be enough. She wanted to meet the Pirate Queen and her boy.
Pirate Queen? Caledonia laughed kindly. Tilly stood before her with eyes alight. Pirates were thieves and scoundrels. I'm not a scoundrel.
But you know what I am?
Tilly shook her head, and Caledonia responded.
I'm a rebel.
And him?
Tilly asked. Pirate, Caledonia conceded, winning a shy laugh from the girl.
You've had your words. Now let's get, Tilly.
Jules tapped her hands on the floor of the deck, starting to descend. Tilly's eyes strayed to Orin, even as she backed toward the ladder and followed her grandmother to the canoe waiting below.
Queen says to meet her after sunrise in the main hall,
Jules called from halfway down the ladder.
Whatever fights ahead of you, I hope you give them hell.
When Caledonia returned to the cabin, Orin had both hammocks hooked into the ceiling with a blanket on each and dinner laid out on the floor. Chicken tossed with glossy brown grains in a bed of gravy, a dish of the same greens as every night before, and twists of a hearty bread. It took them very little time to clear the containers of each and every crumb. As promised, a chill pushed through the windows before long, and the blankets were not only welcome but necessary. There was still a smear of light in the sky when they settled into their hammocks, bellies full and eyelids heavy. Orin raised his arms without complaint. The skin of his wrists was getting worse, rubbing away in places. Caledonia hesitated.
Sit on the floor.
She found what she needed in the small stash of supplies in their bathroom, a glass bottle of disinfectant, a flat tin of salve, and a packet of gauzy bandages. She returned to find him seated on the floor, holding his hands away from his body so they didn't bump or brush unnecessarily. He was hiding his pain, and she wondered just how long he'd been doing so. She crouched next to him, arranging the tin and bandages on the floor, then gently began to work at the knots of his bindings. They were tight, and in the end, there was no other way to release them than to tug. Orin tensed but didn't make a sound. Caledonia did her best to crush a sudden swell of sympathy. It was easy to ignore a thing you didn't care about. But this was not easy. The ropes finally came away, leaving ghostly bindings of blood and ravaged skin in their wake. Orin released a long breath, and Caledonia winced as she inspected the wounds for rot or infection. This is going to feel like hell, Caledonia said, soaking one of the smaller bandages in alcohol.
Don't enjoy it too much,
Orin responded, voice taut.
Don't tell me what to do, she muttered.
He laughed until she pressed the bandage firmly to the top of his wrist, letting the alcohol penetrate the places where the skin was rough or rubbed completely open. Orin's muscles clenched from jaw to thigh, but he held still and didn't flinch when Caledonia lifted the bandage and repeated the process several times over until she'd covered both wrists. Next, she applied the salve, smoothing it across his skin in a thin, oily layer. Finally, she wrapped clean bandages around each wrist. These next? Orin nudged the old rope bindings with his foot. They were stained with his sweat and blood, the fibers darker where they'd pressed against his skin for so many days. They should be burned, their ashes scattered in the ocean. But she had no other options. The only other length of rope was the tether, and if she left him untethered when they left this cabin, she'd be breaking the Queen's rule. Surprising even herself, she frowned.
Yes.
Orin held perfectly still as she worked. She gathered the ropes and carefully wound them around his wrists, then tied the knots gently, giving them more slack than before.
I know I risk my tongue by speaking, he said, climbing into his hammock when she was done. But I would help you.
even if I weren't your prisoner. He looked up, not challenging except in his sincerity. Caledonia rose to her feet. Dusk had finally faded into the horizon, tossing dusty shadows across the cabin. Auron's eyes gleamed with diffused light. The irritation she expected to feel remained distant and dulled. All she felt was a kind of curiosity. "Why?" she asked. "He took my family, too."
"Eric is father to all," she reminded him.
It was the lie Eric wanted them to believe, the one he told over and over again. If he was father to all, then no one needed a family elsewhere.
"I was born in the holster, given to service by the time I was 7. Even our parents tell us Eric is the only father we have, the only father we need. Not all of us believe it."
"Did you?" Caledonia's voice was nearly a whisper.
"Mostly. At first, I had no reason not to."
He paused, searching for something in her eyes.
"But last year, Eric ordered me to prove my devotion and kill my birth father."
Again, Caledonia's voice was thin when she asked.
"Did you?" "No," Auron answered. "But I didn't save him."
A cool breeze shivered through the room, tightening around Caledonia's throat.
"Eric shot him in front of me."
The edge of bitterness in his voice was blade sharp and ready to cut.
"Eric is not my father."
And suddenly, Caledonia heard it. The casual way he said Eric's name without the honorific. Eric a hare, or even simply the father. She thought of his knowledge, how he knew the shipping schedule, how he had drawn the Electra's schematic from memory, how he knew where their brothers would be on the ship. It was not the knowledge of a lowly bullet.
"Who were you to him?" she asked.
Hesitation, a flash of regret, a flash of defiance. Auron was steady as a star in the night sky when he answered,
"A 5-son."
And for the first time, Caledonia believed him without a doubt in her mind.
Chapter 30. That night, Caledonia dreamed of storms. Winds that plucked her ship from the water like it was no more than a shell, flinging them high in the sky where bullet ships waited, guns ready to riddle their hull with fresh holes. They fell again into a sea of glowing blue waters, shadowed and thick with monstrous whales whose bodies were made of twists of shiny metal and dark green seagrass. When they breached the surface with mouths agape, the sound they made was the cacophonous roar of 100 ghost funnels. When she opened her eyes, she found Auron turned on his side, pulled from sleep by whatever noise she'd made, and watching her with a pinch of concern between his brows.
"Don't," she said.
"Don't what?"
"Think of me,"
she said, unable to find any words in her early morning state. She heard more than she saw the smile in his voice when he answered.
"I'm afraid our situation has made that impossible, Captain."
By the time they arrived at the main hall, the sun was just beginning to slip through the trees and stir the village to life. The Queen's people led Auron away as soon as they docked, and a young woman with a babe rounding her belly informed Caledonia that the Queen was ready for her. Caledonia was instantly nervous. This was not a woman she wanted to keep waiting. She was sent into a room adjacent to the main hall where she found the Queen seated at a low table. Today, she was draped in robes of sage green and black, and though she sat on a cushion on the floor, she might as well have been in a throne. Her back was tall and her chin effortlessly high, as though she possessed a vein of precious metal within her,
running through her backbone. Before her, a mottled brown teapot woven with cords of silver released fragrant steam, and the doors and windows had been flung open to the morning light. At each entry, two guards stood with ready weapons.
"Your ship has been repaired, Captain," the Queen said, leaning forward to pour the tea as Caledonia took her seat across the low table.
Caledonia didn't know what to make of the moment. Shouldn't she be the one to serve the Queen and not the other way around? But this wasn't her Queen, merely a woman she'd swiftly come to admire.
"Yes, thank you,"
the Queen continued in her placid way.
"Your galley is stocked with all we can spare, your batteries fully charged, and I understand we've even reinforced your bow. It will make you heavier than before. You'll feel the difference, I expect. Might slow you down, but not by much."
Pisces had overseen this particular improvement. The stays had shown signs of buckling, and the slagger engineers had recommended a full reinforcement of the nose. It had required a considerable amount of slagger resources.
"All of this for saving one of your people. I'm grateful, but this is more than I can promise to repay."
"You saved one of ours, and we are grateful. But I suspect it was not your intention that day. Tell me, Captain, did you set out to save Himei from the bullet fleet?"
Caledonia remembered each of the barges they'd destroyed, but none so clearly as the one on which they'd found Himei. It had been early in their campaign against the Agra fleet. They'd only taken down one other, and the barge had appeared before them like a gift. It floated, unguarded, far from any shore. They approached cautiously at first, but soon realized that the barge was in distress. The flowers were wilted under the brutal summer sun, and no one stood on deck to tend them. When they boarded, they found four scythes below decks. One was dead, her small body stiff in her cot. One was feverish and pale, shivering on the floor. The other two, deranged by a combination of fever and silt, rushed at Red Tooth's boarding party. They died quickly, and Red Tooth returned to the Moor's Navis with the only surviving girl in her arms. The one who'd been collapsed on the floor. The terrible truth was that Himei only lived because she hadn't been well enough to fight them.
"No," Caledonia answered simply.
The Queen paused, drawing her steaming cup into her hands and rolling it between her palms.
"We have no choice but to feed Arik's demand for iron, silver, and most of all, steel. These are the things he knows we have. We cannot resist."
Caledonia felt herself mirroring the Queen's movements, pulling her own cup into her hands and rolling it between her palms. The steam smelled of honeysuckle and moss.
"When he takes more than our metals, we have no recourse. If we resist, we will lose the very small amount of freedom we have here."
The Queen sipped her tea, then set her cup on the table.
"But the danger of preserving small freedoms is complacency. Complicity. I cannot do much for you, Captain. But I can do this. Take your ship, take your crew, and prove to that man that he has not quelled all of us. Prove that there is a fire on these seas he cannot contain."
The words wrapped Caledonia in a fierce embrace. Her skin felt hot, her heart both buoyant and heavy. She wasn't sure of her voice, but she was sure she needed to speak. She clenched her teeth and responded,
"I promise."
The Queen nodded, sipped her tea, then gathered her robes and rose to her feet.
"I hope the water returns you to us one day, Captain. But if it does not, then I hope it carries you well."
Caledonia searched for something to say in return. May the seas bring you all that you need. A smile spread across the queen's face. A smile like the bending crest of a wave, brief and beautiful. Then she turned and left Caledonia alone in the room. By mid-morning, the crew was ready to depart. The Moors Navis had been taken out of the village and awaited them in deeper waters, where Sipa also waited to lead them safely through the grasses. Caledonia stood on the deck of the main hall as her crew boarded mud runners and was carried away. Red Tooth stood at her side, carefully scrawling each girl's name on a small pad of paper. Pisces had gone ahead with Orin in tow to make the ship ready and organize the crew as they arrived. Amina should have gone with her, but refused. She stood on the deck with Caledonia and Red Tooth. But while they watched after the departing crew, Amina kept her eyes on the village waterways, waiting. Hime had been absent since that first day in the Drowning Lands, but the entire village was aware they were leaving today. When all but the three of them were accounted for, it was time to go. A single mud runner waited on the ramp. The water below was littered with a few boats, curious villagers come to see the crew of girls leave. The deck, however, was clear. It was the three of them and no one else. 50 names in all lay on Red's list. They made 53. One less than it would have been 7 days ago. For the first time, Caledonia felt the hard truth of this moment. Even though their ship was in new repair and their stores were replenished, they were leaving with so much less than they had when they arrived. This is our fault, Amina said, voice thick. My fault. This isn't your fault, Caledonia insisted. If you need to blame anyone, blame me. I'm the one who kept her below decks. And I'm the one who got us stuck here in the first place. Don't you think she'll at least come to say goodbye? Red Tooth asked. It was hard not to recall Orin's words. He'd been sure that Hime would come with them, and Caledonia found now that part of her had believed him. But it simply wasn't true, and Caledonia didn't want to linger in this moment. The longer it lasted, the harder it became. Come on.
I don't think I can just leave. Amina's words sounded deflated. How can I just leave her?
What do the spirits say?
From Caledonia, this question would have sounded antagonizing. From Red Tooth, it was just a question. Amina tipped her head toward the sky, eyes searching for the things Caledonia never seemed to see. Tears welled and spilled down her cheeks.
It's time to go.
The three girls boarded the mud runner, Caledonia the last. She was angry now that Hime had not even come to say goodbye. Hadn't she loved them enough for that? The journey to the ship was a quiet one. They whipped through the ghostly tunneled trees and into the marshy lands beyond. The sun was brilliant overhead, and so much hotter without a cover of trees to protect them. Red Tooth sat close to Amina, occasionally reaching out to stroke the girl's cheek or drop a kiss on her shoulder. Caledonia turned her face upward and tried to think kindly of Hime. With them or not, she was still a girl of her crew. She owed them nothing beyond what she'd already given. When the profile of the Moors Navis appeared ahead, sharp and sleek against the sparkling water, Caledonia felt a knot inside her release. Home. That ship was the only home she'd ever known, and once again it was whole and powerful and ready. Her feet tapped on the floor, anxious to settle into the variable rhythm of the waves, hungry for the grit of the main deck. They'd lost days to the Drowning Lands, and she was ready to make up for it. As they drew near, they found the empty mudrunners now fanned around the nose of the ship,